This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Let me welcome you to another of the CSHE colloquia. I'm Michael Nacht, Interim Director of the Center, and this is our last colloquium before spring break. We'll tell you a little bit after David's presentation and Q&A about coming attractions for what happens next. This is a special treat for me to introduce my longtime colleague and friend, David Kerp, who many of you know. He told me to keep the introduction very short, so I've cut it to 2 hours. So here are some of the highlights, in case you don't know. He's an Amherst honors graduate, Harvard Law School, started an educational program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, I believe. Mm-hmm. Then came to Berkeley and was on the faculty of the Goldman School for over 40 years. He started when he was 9. Today he is a professor in the graduate school. He is a senior fellow at the Learning Policy Institute, which is an exciting new venture in Palo Alto. He might want to talk about it at some point. I don't know if you do. And he's also a contributing writer to the New York Times. So he's a very busy fellow. The subject of today's presentation, The College Dropout Scandal, is the subject of his 18th book. 17 have been published. Oxford Press, I believe, is in the works. So this is you're going to be in for a real treat. Please welcome David Kerp.
Thank you, Michael. So I expected a small group on the order of what used to happen at the center when people sat around a little table and chatted. So it's great to see you all. This is the first talk that I have given about this project. It is, I would say someplace in the neighborhood of third to half done. So most people give talks when they're all polished and ready to go, and then people in the audience sort of see what they can do to shoot them down. This is really meant to be very different. It's a talk in progress, and so what I'm looking for are people who are going to be friendly critics or critical friends of what it is that I have to say, because I'm going to learn more from you than you're going to learn from me. So let me begin by saying that if you're out there in the world and you think about college and what the problems are, the big issue always is college access. That's what people are talking about. You know, tuition is too high, make tuition, you know, eliminate tuition, bring in more students. And comparatively little focus is given to college dropouts. In this room, that may be an exception, but you're out there in the world. It's not something that people may pay much attention to. Actually, if we were to ask our colleagues here at Berkeley on campus what percentage of the students graduate in 4 years, what percentage of the students graduate in 6 years, people would make wild guesses, but they wouldn't have a clue by and large. It's not the way people think. And I actually will come back to Berkeley in a moment. But I'd argue that the dropout issue is really a bigger problem. So to ease the suspense, the four-year graduation rate, many of us went to college for 4 years, remember that? The four-year college graduation rate is about 35%. The six-year graduation rate is 61%. That means nearly 4 in 10 students leave college without a degree, with nothing to show for it, except lots of bills. And they and we, taxpayers, wind up footing the bill. So that's the problem. The estimate by the American Institutes of Research is that about $4.5 billion in lost wages and taxes are lost each year. And that calculation does not, of course, account for the kinds of the stunted lives, the foreshortened futures that happen to students who wind up dropping out of school. So that's the problem. There is an answer to this question, which I find amazing. I've spent much of my life working in K-12, which is a swamp filled with snakes, and in early education more recently, which you're really building a new system. Lots of people excited about early education, but it's money and training and facilities and quality controls and all that. Here, there really are things that universities can do. Strategies, evidence-based strategies that can move the needle on student success and that are scalable. So there's an answer. But little is being done. If you look at the data on college dropouts over the last 10 years, there's a slight increase in the number of dropouts over that period of time. So that's the scandal. Big problem, solutions at hand, little being done about that. Hence the title. By the way, when I submitted this proposal to Oxford Press, some academic reading the book said, scandal, that's such a strong word. How about the college dropout problem? I fell asleep in the middle of the word problem. So it is the college dropout scandal. I said, how about fiasco? Is that better? So how do people explain this away? Well, for one thing, they say, presidents and chancellors, they got a lot on their plate. They do have a lot on their plate. They have to raise money. They've got to placate alumni. They've got to deal with legislators. They've got to deal with their own faculty, the herd of cats that we are. That's too much to make student success a priority. Now, I will say that at every campus where student success has been demonstrated, that is, where there are substantially more graduates and where the opportunity gap has closed in recent years, you've had a leader who said, this is on the top of my list, and he or she has designated a staff person, often a provost, whose entire mission is to bring the campus together around the issue of student success. So it's doable. I've also heard from presidents that it's too hard. This is too hard to do. One president of a school, Georgia State, which I'll talk about later, that's been very successful, said when he talks to lots of presidents come by and look at what they've done, and then they shake their heads and say, in effect, I'm scared of the deans. I can't do this because I'm going to be breaking some eggs and the deans are going to, rise up and revolt. Henry, would you revolt if there was a? No, I didn't think so. So we have my dean and my former dean. Are exceptions to this rule. Plainly put, I've never heard of anybody getting fired because of the high dropout rates at the school they were in. So you do this because it's a moral imperative, because you care about students, not because your job is on the line. Faculty's complaint. You give us better students, and we'll get better graduation rates. The problem, as you'll see, is that just doesn't wash in terms of students, the same kinds of students coming to universities have very different graduation rates. There's lots of rhetoric around student success. It's very hard to go to any gathering of top administrators where the word does not show up, but very little effort to implement or evaluate programs that are there. Berkeley is an exception to the following proposition, which is that institutional research is so bad across the country that if faculty research were of comparable quality, the wheel would never have been invented. Okay, what does the evidence look like? As I said, equally selective universities have very different graduation rates, and universities with very similar graduation rates have bigger and smaller gaps between the overall rate and the minority graduation rate. If you're curious, I've turned into this sort of somebody who keeps going back to this site called collegeresults.org, which does a lot of this kind of compare and contrast that you'll see, and just pick a couple of schools. The book, with almost without exception, focuses on regional universities and community colleges, mostly universities, because that's where the money is, as the old line goes. That's where the students are. They're not at places like Berkeley. But I thought, inquiring minds want to know, so I would compare Berkeley and UCLA, see what I got. So UCLA has more Pell Grant students, a larger percentage of underrepresented minority students, 21% versus 15%, and its entering students have lower SATs. So with those figures, you would expect lower graduation rates, et cetera. What you find is the graduation rate, six-year graduation rate, is about the same, although UCLA's graduation rate has gone up in recent years. Berkeley's has remained stagnant. But what's more interesting is the difference in the graduation of minority students. So remember, the overall graduation rate is 91%, underrepresented minority graduation rate, 84%, the African-American graduation rate, 81%. We can do a lot better than that. They can do a lot better than that. Anybody can do a lot better than that. The data, as you'll see, show that there are good schools, excellent schools, in which the minority graduation rate is actually higher than the overall graduation rate. Something that is bound to come to come as a surprise. Excuse me, as a surprise for many of you. Okay, University of California. Underrepresented minorities, graduation rate is 82% versus 84%, but only 74% of the African-American students graduate in 6 years. 74% versus 81%. That suggests that there is work to be done on this campus. And this campus, unfortunately, looks like lots of others. If you ask about student success programs, they're all over the place. Right? There are dozens and dozens of them, but nobody knows if any of them work. Nobody coordinates any of them. Nobody figures out where funding should go. They just grow like Topsy. And if you ask students who come here, basically, they don't get look to the right of you, look to the left of you, somebody, you know, isn't going to be here. But they do get, this is tough. Berkeley is tough. You got to work hard. You know, it's up to you. And then there are all these activities out there in the world. We actually can learn a lot from first and second tier places. So, my favorite or least favorite example is a comparison between Georgia State and Wayne State University in Detroit. Now, if you look at the data, they look almost identical. The percentage of students who admitted, their high school GPAs, their family income, their SAT scores. Georgia State has 48% underrepresented minority students. Wayne State just 24%, half as many. The graduation rates between these two almost identical schools are entirely different. At Georgia State, 53% of the students graduate. That's up 10% in a decade, and they're certainly not done. At Wayne State, the overall figure is 34%. Okay? Almost 20% different if you do that. It's by raw statistics. But it's where the Black and Latino and first gen and Pell Grant students become part of the story that the differences are just glaring. At Georgia State, the graduation rate for Black and Latino students is 56%. That is 3% higher than the overall graduation rate. Ready for this? Graduation rate for underrepresented minorities at Wayne State is 14%. In other words, an African-American student who goes to Wayne State would have a 4 times better chance of graduating if she went to Wayne State. Now, what's going on at Wayne State? I don't know, but I'm about to find out. I have a connection to the president. I have other faculty connections there, and I really do want to learn what those figures mean and what, if anything, the university is doing to change that story. I've been to Georgia State. I've been to a number of other places that are doing well, because as a policy guy, I'm not interested in piling on. That's easily done. I'm interested in figuring out what strategies university use that move the needle on this story. Now, because I want to make this a relatively short talk, I'm going to talk just about a couple of strategies and a couple of places. Lots more to be had. Together with some wonderful RAs, I visited the community colleges at the City University of New York. They are fantastic. One program removed their graduation rate from 15%, which is the national average for urban community colleges, 15% of the students, to 64% of the students. And they're amazing. So I've been there. I've been to Long Beach State, Cal State Long Beach, University of Texas, University of Rutgers at Newark, University of Central Florida, which I'd never heard of before, but which graduates more students than any other school in the country, and which has a 76% graduation rate. That puts it on a par with places like the University of Illinois and the University of Florida. The answers to these questions, the answers are there, and it really is not about brain surgery. It's doable stuff. So there are two approaches. One of them is you change the exoskeleton of the institution. The other is that you help make students more resilient. These are not mutually exclusive, but and many schools do variations on a theme of both of them. Let's talk about Georgia State, which you've been hearing about a lot. I just got a sweatshirt from them in the mail. I thought about wearing it today, but that seemed like undue advertising. So what Georgia State did was to say, it's not on them, at least a good chunk of it is on us. So what that school did was it looked to see where are the roadblocks to graduation, and then to do something about those roadblocks. What can we do to change that situation? Now, almost every one of these universities, these second-tier regional universities, and some of the bigger, better-known universities as well, the issue is math. Community college, it's basic algebra. At universities, it's college-level algebra, or some places have wakened up to the fact that more students are going to find use in college-level statistics than college-level algebra. But you find, typically, in these courses, half the students, at least, fail those courses first time out, and a third of the students fail those courses second time out. They're getting no credit for that. In states that have scholarship funds, like Georgia, they're getting no money for that. So they get discouraged, they get broke, and they leave. So what Georgia did about, so it started at the beginning. It started with its summer program. Now, Georgia State admits everybody who passes the Georgia equivalent of the A to G requirements. You admit those, and it admits now everybody who's graduated from the community college. They've absorbed, at the state's behest, the local community college. Its graduation rate, when it took it over last year, was 3%. So, no place to go but up. It starts with a summer program, a very intense academic and social support program. And it reaches out to students generally. It's focused particularly on students that it thinks are of high risk of not doing well, but it doesn't limit itself to those students. When I talked to students at Georgia State and asked them about this, they said, you know, when we got this invitation, our first thought was that we were the dummies. That's why they were doing this. And we looked around and we saw who was there, including some sophomores who decided they wanted to do some courses that were offered in the summer. These guys collect and make use of data in a way that no other school in the country does. So we hear about big data all the time, big data. Data are dumb. People are smart. You can have as many data points as you'd like, but if you don't know what questions to ask, you're just going to flounder in those numbers. This is the most sophisticated use of data that I've encountered in the country. Let me give you two examples. A good university typically will flag a student who fails her midterm exam, and they might call that student in for a conversation, and then they get really worried when a student fails the course. So it turns out that a student who gets a C+ in her introductory course in a major is 4 times less likely to graduate in that major than a student who gets an A-. Now that's a very interesting piece of data to talk about with the students. The nursing program, which is hugely selective, just has to do with a whole bunch of factors in the state of Georgia that limit opportunities for students. It's the most selective program in the school. So it used to believe that its introductory nursing course was the course where the grade was crucial. But when the data were run, it turned out that was wrong. In fact, the crucial course was the introductory algebra course. You wouldn't know these things unless you decided to ask those things. Now, the school doesn't want students to flounder and take courses all over the place. You can do that. At Berkeley, you've got the luxury of taking a range of courses. You can take the art history course, and you can take the music course, and the philosophy course, and the science for poets class. And you can do some of that at Georgia State. But the idea is to get students on track to graduate. They're not insisting that students pick a major on the outset, but they are saying by the time you're sophomores, you want to pick what they call a meta major. You want to decide that you want to graduate someplace in the human services field or in STEM or in business or in media studies. There are a whole array of courses. So if you wind up doing badly, you say, God, I want it, as one student who I observed in one of these sessions said, I really, really wanted to do journalism, but I got, you know, C+s or C's in my first two courses. You need a C+ in those courses to major in that field. Well, listening to the conversation between her and a counselor, it became clear that media studies was not only a possibility, it was a better choice for her given what it was that she wanted to do. She still had to get those C pluses in those courses, but now she had a sense of what the stakes look like. There are just-in-time alerts for students who seem to be in trouble. And if you're really in trouble, if it looks like you haven't been in a lot of classes or you're failing exams or whatever, the counselors don't sit there and waiting for you to say, oh my gosh, I've got a problem. They reach out to you and they say, come see me. And they see there are 30,000 undergraduates at Georgia State. Seniors are advised by the different colleges, like the business school, the education school. That leaves about, 24,000 freshmen through juniors. They have 40,000 appointments a year for those students, just sort of visits, individual one-on-one visits. I thought, oh my gosh, what's this going to be like? The counselor is going to have a piece of paper. All this predictive stuff is going to say, sorry, you got a C+, therefore you should get out of this major and do basket weaving or something like that. By the way, it turns out that the institution instituting of this set of analytics has meant that the biggest increase in majors, has led to the biggest increase in majors in the STEM fields. Why? Because of the early coaching and early support that these students get. Another little thing. Seniors were dropping out. Why were seniors? They were dropping out because, or they were being pushed out, as it turned out, because they hadn't paid their bills, and the financial office said, sorry, if you don't pay your bill by date X, you're gone. So it turns out that many of these students really they'd run through their HOPE scholarships. They'd run through their Pell Grants. They were working two jobs, but still, they were $1,000 or $500 short. So what does Georgia State do? It gives them that money, just hands it out. But when they first started this, they called the students up and said, we're going to give you $1,000. The students hung up. They thought this was a hoax. Who's going to give me $1,000 to do something? But, they got the idea. 400 students a year get those micro grants. We can't say that all of them wouldn't have graduated, but all of them had been on the verge of, or basically had been told, if you don't pay up in the next month or so, you're gone. That's not hard to do. So that's one approach. And versions of data analytics are used widely, but nothing quite as impressively as there. The other approach is to make students, enable students to be more resilient in the face of the predictable adversity that they're going to encounter. They get a failing grade in their first course, or their first paper. They just think that they're dumb when they go to school. They don't have the brain power to succeed. They don't belong. They don't fit in. I don't know how many of you had the feeling of not belonging, but it really resonates with me. I went to Amherst College, and I was sure that I would be the last person in my class. They had made a mistake. There I was, and the college did nothing to disabuse me of that belief for the first year that I was there. So I do get it. But imagine how much more intense that feeling is for minority students and first-gen students and poor students who already are dealing with the fact that they think people think they are dumb. They suffer from what Claude Steele calls stereotype vulnerability. So just a little push over that ledge can confirm their view that they just don't fit. Now, social psychologists have developed strategies that focus on students at that key transition point, designed to give students an understanding that they do belong and that they're not dumb. And how do they do it? Very simply, with respect to belonging, for example, they'll watch videos in which you get upper-class students from their school saying, when I came here, I was scared to death. And my first grade in that course was just terrible. But I learned that professor was really a tough grader. I reached out. I started talking to other students about what was going on. I got some courage, and I started talking to my professors. And, they weren't ogres. And there I was. The work on mindset really looks at the brain is not, you're not cooked, when you're born. Many people really believe that genes are everything. They would die if you said that to them, but that's what they believe. They believe that they are no smarter than they've demonstrated that they're smart. So if they don't do well on a problem, they give up. And the basic, you know, lay version of mindset is to break into that by describing basic brain development. The brain is a muscle. It grows. It continues to grow with practice. And by the way, these strategies, I'm describing them being used in higher education. They're also being used in middle schools and high schools, and even in some places as early as elementary schools. I remember watching a kid in a second grade class, and a boy was just sort of fooling around, and she turned to him and said, you know, this is, you're not really using your, you know, your brain. You're not using this is a mindset issue. You've got to get yourself around this problem. So social psychologists are very careful with the work that they do. They do small studies and more small studies. This research, some of it dates to the 1980s. A lot of it has been going on since the 1990s. But the first, they're interested now in seeing if they can bring that work to scale. And so in one flagship university, this, by the way, is a paper published in PNAS last June, they gave half the students in the entering freshman class, which is thousands of students, the belonging experience, which I've described. Half of them got nothing. It's a computer exercise at home, part of the package of things that students do before they enter college. And what they found, they were looking, and they're following, they continue to follow these students. They initially focused on persistence to sophomore year. How many students, what percentage of students, entered their second year on track to graduate in 4 years? Okay? Which is a very good predictor of four-year and six-year graduation rates. So that the year of that experiment, nothing happened to middle-class white kids. But for minority students, the persistence rate went from 80% to 83%. Now, if I do the math right, that's a 15% increase in terms of persistence. And a little experiment got conducted because a top administrator of the school said, I don't believe in any of this stuff. And lots of people don't believe in any of this stuff. They think it's too good to be true. They think it's magic. So what they did, he said, I've got the programs that'll do it. So a whole bunch of support programs, many of which are good, many of which not so good. Guess what? That persistence rate fell to 80% from 83%. And he decided he was wrong, and that's now sort of embedded in the introduction to that university. So, as I said, there's lots of people who don't believe any of this. When the proposal for this book was being, the same person who said, how about, you know, the dropout problem, said, I don't believe that you know, social psychologists are right that you can actually change how people do. Period. Full stop, no footnotes, no whatever. I mean, this is sort of Donald Trump when it comes to academe, right? No, don't confuse me with the facts. I'm just going to tell you. This is alt facts, right? Just happens to be coming from a professor. And, you know, so next time round with that proposal, I took all the footnotes that I had, which I'd removed for ease of reading, stuck them back in the proposal. He had a list of references, and he decided that maybe he should read something. But people don't believe this. They don't believe this. And it's not magic, because this is something that psychologists have known for a long time. If you reach, the key is not the length of the intervention, the key is the timing of the intervention. Students who are going to college, think back to yourself going to college, are particularly open to hearing messages about what's life going to be like and what they can do to do better. And an earlier study at an elite institution had a longer early intervention. It was an hour long and it was in person, but the same approach. African-American students at that school were regularly they underperformed based on what the predictions were. In the bottom, concentrated in the bottom third of their class. That difference went away. By senior year, they kept studying these guys. They were healthier. You measure that by visits to the health center. They reported that they were happier, more engaged, and they followed these students into the work world for the first 4 or 5 years. They're doing better, they're happier, and when you trace back, as the researchers have done, what the explanation for this is, we factor out the various aspects of the students who are doing well, it turns out that it was contact with professors. It was interaction with professors that was the key factor in this story. Now, plainly, from those numbers, These interventions are not going to solve the problem, right? But they're going to go a long way to helping, along with other things that an institution should do. And better yet, you can bake them into courses. So the Carnegie Center for Advanced Teaching in Menlo Park has developed courses called Mathway and Statway, which have huge impact on pass rates for college students. And what do? They make the courses more relevant. They explain to students, why should you care about a square root? Something I need to find out. They make the courses more engagingly taught, and they build in the appropriate moments without saying this is a belonging moment. They build in those kinds of factors. Other places, other strategies, other institutions have picked strategies that they know from the evidence works for them. Now, the next step in this process, and I hope I can contribute in some small way, is to make educators and the public aware that there is a problem and to find college leaders who are willing and able to tackle it. Thank you.
Questions?
Questions. There's a mic running around here someplace.
I'm John Prowse from the College of Chemistry. What about standards? There must be a temptation to lower standards to raise graduation rates.
So if I told you, Mr. Chemistry Professor, look at those graduation rates. Look at the pass rate in your weed out course. All those people who wanted to be doctors, they took your course. Now they're going to be, Lord knows, their hearts are going to be broken. Well, you might say, you know, tough on them, or you might say, let me look around and see if there are pedagogies that work better with the same level of rigor. And they've tested that out. Two sections of a big basic chemistry course at Texas. You know, one using, you know, lots of tutoring available, you know, different teaching methodology, not straight lecturing, and the other just the old-fashioned course. Big difference in passing rates. So the two things people say to me are that, you know, are teachers pampering the students, which I worried about a lot. But then I thought about it. If somebody came to most professors and said, you gotta lighten up in your grades, they're not going to, you know, there's a revolt happening. The other thing people said, when I wrote about Georgia State, they said, oh, they're coddling the students. This is New York Times readers talking about kids. Look at who those kids are. You know, coddling, you know, poor first-gen minority students, coddling them by having counseling available to them. Just remember what life was like when you were in college, and if you had a problem, there were hot and cold running counselors available to you to go, you know, go coddle you. So that was the other question that people raised. It's a very important question, but, and I've asked it all over the place, but I'm persuaded.
So, hi, I'm Cynthia Schrager. I used to work here at UC Berkeley, and I'm now working on some projects related to student success in the California Community College system and in the CSU system. And my question is, since we know there are these evidence-based strategies that work, and we also know that the mission of student success is central, no one would really take issue with it. It seems then that the challenge is really something to do with culture. And I'm wondering what you see the cultural barriers being, and also for the institutions you've studied that have gotten over this hurdle, what was the secret ingredient in terms of changing culture?
Until you got to secret ingredient, I was with you. Everybody wants a secret ingredient, right? Everybody wants the magic bullet. There is no secret ingredient. But the question you raise is really important. And the answer at every place I've looked at is that the change comes from the top. You enlist professors and department chairs to go along with the mission, but unless it's clear that the university cares about it, unless it's a message that comes from the university, nothing is going to happen except at the individual professor level. So, just take Long Beach State, one of my other hero institutions. You had a president, King Alexander, who cared enough about this to say to his provost, you're going to do this. And he took it upon himself to look at what programs were data-based and implement them across the campus. That meant taking programs that didn't work away from the colleges. Imagine. This is my afraid of the dean story. He wasn't afraid of the deans. And all of a sudden, people started looking at the data because the data were out there. I mean, if you went to Perimeter College, you know, or you went to Laney, I don't know what the graduation rate is at Laney. You went to Laney and told professors, your graduation rate is 12%. That's a guess, between 12 and 15%. Three-year graduation rate. It's just shocking. You go to the faculty at Wayne State and say, look at the comparison between you guys and Georgia State. What are we going to do about this? Let's run out of excuses. Let's see what it is that we're going to do about this. It takes time. Universities are very conservative cultural institutions. But you're appealing to people's sense of mission. I don't think most professors like to be teaching classes in which they fail 70% of their students. I don't think they find that to be fun, particularly if it turns out that there's a way that they can move most of those students from D's and F's to C's, B's, and A's, which is what the data show. So I think part of it is just, it's not just self-interest of the professors, it's this is our reminding professors, us, that this is our mission, this is our calling. We want to make students successful. We want to be coaches, not judges, in what we're doing.
Carl Pister, engineering. I have.
By the way, if there are students in the audience, and my hunch is that there are, I'd like the next couple of questions to come from students so that we old guys don't dominate the proceedings. Carl?
Hello. I'm back here, sir. You're looking in the wrong direction. I'm back here.
Got it.
Okay.
Got it.
I'm hidden in the fog. Your talk raised two points for me. First of all, I think we would learn a lot more about the scandal if we treated it not as a number but as a distribution. In other words, thinking of the different reasons for dropout and the consequences, if we could be so luxurious as to have longitudinal studies of people that dropped out. You have the three sigma people like Bill Gates and Steve Wozniak who dropped out, and I don't think we'd call them a failure. But what are the other ones in the middle that may have very legitimate careers after they drop out? So it'd be nice to be able to do more longitudinal studies of
that.
Well,
I love the Bill Gates, Steve Wozniak story, but with respect, anecdote plus anecdote yields anecdote.
So there are points on a distribution.
But if you look overall at the students who drop out and you compare them to the students who graduate, huge income gap between them. Now, yes, it would be lovely, and I agree with you, to do a finer-grained analysis to figure out what it was that helped those students and also what it was that led them to drop out.
Exactly.
Because one of the key we know from these interventions that institutions can make a difference.
Yep.
That Georgia State could get from a 30-some-odd percent to 57%. And indeed, Georgia State does what other institutions don't do, which is it actually has the data to follow its students, those students who graduated from someplace else. That data is not available. And they do. Imagine the graduation rate goes up. But still, I asked the president, what can you do about the other students? And he said, you run into, it's for the other students, for 25% of these students, it's money.
Well, that's my second point. There's an underlying policy issue here that has a dramatic effect on graduation rates. In the 80s and more generally in the 90s, the university had significant resources dedicated to programs that worked for underrepresented students, for example. Prop 209 took the foundation out of those programs, and that's the tragedy. It's one of getting resources that would scale so that students that need this kind of assistance could get it.
So it's a very important point, and I want to say, again, it's a matter of administrative will, because those cuts, cuts generally, this state was particularly hit by this double whammy, right? Although looking holistically at admissions helps some to deal with that. But then the question is, when you have cuts, what do you cut? And at many places, student services are the first thing to go. At Georgia State, they increased student services. They trimmed administrators. That's a choice. That's a priority to be made, And, Faith and Megory, it worked. So are there some brave students out there who want to talk
I'm
to
not
me?
A student, but I just want to throw in an independent corroboration of what David
I'll
said.
I'll take that.
And it's particularly aimed at the scientists, of whom I recognize many in the room, which is I heard a talk at the American Association for the Advancement of Science that was in a room about this size that had approximately four times as many people on the floor all over the place, packed. And it was a woman from Georgia State who went there because of the presidential leadership, and she talked about the STEM outcomes, and they are more astonishing for black and brown students at Georgia State than you could believe. I mean,
yep.
Just like, because if you uncover the thing, you don't just look at first gen, poverty, language, et cetera, gender. If you look at by major, and so those people who teach Math 1A, which is our ball buster here, sometimes love the body count. But most people who teach Math 1A try to do a good job, right?
Yep.
But
yep.
The problem is that unless the graduate assistants are actually onto a belonging track, and I'm not talking about bringing cupcakes. I am actually talking about the interactions and then the interactions of the faculty. And it's every step of the way. And I think it's the coherence that is bottom up meets top down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a particularly effective in the sciences, especially when here we have a College of Chemistry, a College of Engineering, you know, Letters in Science, CNR, et cetera. It's super important that the face-to-face regular contacts kids have reinforced that message of belonging.
So just to footnote that point, Georgia State graduates more African-American engineers than any school in the country. Okay, yes. Can we get a mic? Graduate students are,
yep.
You guys are good.
So,
you're good. You've got to learn about belonging, but otherwise you're good.
Tell me about it. I'm in economics, so. So I think you are focusing on the top down that a lot of the change happened because of a change in leadership, but, I mean, you're not going to – is that the only way? Like, how did the president at Georgia State have to – do a lot of cajoling and a lot of negotiation with the deans and with the faculty there, or are there other examples of this happening where aspects of the leadership at a university came together and convinced the higher-ups to make this happen?
I mean, this is always a problem, right? This is, this, you know, so you start, you look, I look at examples of outsized successes. That was the dependent variable in this story. You look back. Do you see what's going on? Then you talk to people at those places, and you ask them, have they talked to you know, what do their colleagues say? An admittedly imperfect sample, right? And their colleagues will point to X, Y, and Z. I don't know. And look, I am not a top-down guy. I was surprised to hear that. I don't know. I do know that there are places in which a dean would say, we're going to focus on this. This is not right. But remember that chemistry course I just described to you? It wasn't an experiment. This is real, right? Chemistry course sitting over here, chemistry course sitting over here, same final exam, really different grade distribution, random distribution of students. You know how many other chemistry professors decided they would take up the idea of the success course? None. Hard. It's hard work. Change is hard work. You know, we have a love-hate relationship with the idea of change, and most of us, none of us are trained as teachers, which is amazing, right? You know, the best teaching, this is one of my little sermonettes, the best teaching is done by preschool teachers, and if you don't believe me, you owe it to yourself to visit a preschool. The worst the farther up the grade level you go, the worse the teaching becomes, the more the prestige in dollars. And here we are, right? Relatively, making the big bucks, whining about, you know, three courses a year, and not knowing. Some of us are great teachers, but we just learn that on the fly. So to talk to your point about TAs, you know, those guys get very hefty training before they go into the classroom. You don't just, here's a TA, you know, okay, you know how to do it. You know, you had a course, or you had my course, and you did really well, therefore, you know, you can go be a TA in that class. You know what happens? Some TAs are great, some TAs are terrible. You can improve the quality of teaching assistants. You can improve the quality of teaching. Now, it's really hard to tell a professor, you've got to go through a process of learning about doing better teaching. But if you encourage that, if you find ways of encouraging that, makes a difference. If you're a philosopher, you're in the philosophy department at Georgia State. Philosophy departments are male-dominated in terms of their students. The whole variety of things that they did, there are now half of the students in that department are women. That's unheard of. They decided it was a problem, and they figured out how to make it happen. And one of the things, this is, again, hard work. So that a lot of the classrooms became, in effect, flipped classrooms, in which the homework is done, you know, the sort of lectures are done at home, and the classwork is devoted to discussion of the problems. One course, they had students working individually on these homework, these lecture assignments. Another, they tried that in one course, it worked really well. Another very similarly basic course didn't work at all. It only worked if you had one student working alone. So there's a whole lot of trial and error going on in this process. But you gotta start by caring. And if you have somebody who reinforces this, who, God forbid, actually gives you some money, you know, professors actually, by and large, come pretty cheap. I found out when I've had small grants to encourage summer projects. They want to do interesting, they want peers, and they want something interesting to do. So you can actually affect, if you're sitting up there and you've got that little pot of money, you can affect the quality of teaching. And you can certainly have TAs better trained than they are. I know there's a TA training, but I suspect we could do a whole lot better than what goes on, having lectured in that mass course. Lecturing, the worst thing one could do.
I have a question about standards, back to standards. I have a friend who's a math professor at Chabot Community College in Hayward, and she is increasingly frustrated that she's being pressured to lower standards or even change courses for pass rates, and she's concerned that people are not going to be prepared for the four-year institutions. What, having the pass rate being the key performance indicator, what other data would you collect in conjunction to ensure quality?
Well, one question I'd ask is, what does her pass rate look like compared to her colleagues' classmates? Because lots of people are teaching that class. And then I talk to them. Are you teaching the same course? Do you have the same standards? What are you doing? Right? The problem is real when it comes to adjuncts. Because they really, you know, they don't have a whole lot of pushback opportunities. But again, you want to learn, you know, from your peers and from out there, materials out there in the world. You don't have to lower your standards to improve pass rates. You double the pass rate in the same difficulty, of course, if you use quantways or statways as opposed to using teaching quantitative methods or statistics. So you got to find out what's out there. You got to push back. It's tough. I mean, those are tough situations. Those are really tough situations, and I wouldn't deny they exist. But there are things you can do for starters to help. Microphone over here.
Please identify yourself.
Thanks. Hi, I'm a local. My name is David Trilling. And what I was wondering is, it sounds like you're talking primarily about community colleges, so this might not apply, but...
I'm not. I'm talking about the University of Texas. I'm talking about Long Beach State. I'm talking about, God help us, Amherst College.
Okay, well then this does apply, which is in terms of incentives. So I know a lot of places, particularly professional schools, care deeply about ratings. Rankings, you know, are they the number 5 or number 10 or whatever. Is there a way to add this criteria to the and what other incentives are there for like the head of Long Beach State or Georgia to besides, you know, their feeling that things are going better, what other external things are there for them to try to do that?
I truly don't know how. I agree with you that ratings play an outsized influence, and that the criteria used by those rating systems are faulty. Now, one measure you could add, and there are measures out there to do this, and there are actually have been not national but widely used measures, is student engagement. And you can look at things like, you know, does the student talk to a professor? Does the student talk to a TA? Does the student stick around after class? Does the student join an activity? A whole bunch of things that have been used to identify. Is the student really part of the process? Because that's certainly an important factor in getting the student to decide it's worth sticking around. Now, having said that, Long Beach State's secret sauce is that it has a system that begins at preschool and goes through graduate school. And it really does have that system. I sat in a meeting of the mayor, the superintendent of schools, the community college president, university president. It was a conversation like this. There was no sense of hierarchy, no sense of turf. And that worked enormously well. Long Beach State has the sixth highest number of applicants in the country. Long Beach State could look a whole lot better in terms of selectivity if it admitted the students from around here with a glossier records. It again takes every student who's passed the A to G requirements, regardless of how well they've done. It's the math, the introductory math class in the community colleges doesn't require this horrific entrance exam. Hi, welcome, here's your high-stakes exam, go flunk. It doesn't do that. It relies on high school grades. Imagine the trust you've got to have in the teachers in the high schools to believe in that. The data are a whole lot better in terms of what the effect is. And it's made a huge difference in what it is that's going on. The students who come in that pass their A to G requirements, who look less good on paper than the students that they're turning down, do at least as well academically, because there's a sense of belonging to the community. It's not a perfect system. A community college needs a lot of work, but they know it, and they're doing their best to make it happen. But the four-year school has just soared because they had a provost who actually centralized authority, made student success a priority. Now, his successor is doing what you would like people to do. He goes to the colleges. Sort of what happened at Texas, and says, okay, I've got this pot of money, but you know how to spend it. Let's talk about what you're going to do. And the business school is going to do something different from the education school. And that's, you know, be interesting to see what happens at Long Beach. At Texas is under the gun because it had, over one class, it had to improve the four-year graduation rate from 53 to 70%. They will know this September whether they've succeeded, but you can imagine how much individual attention is now being lavished on students, right, one by one, to get them over that mark. And interestingly, what did Texas do? Its very much cruder predictive analytics system could tell you what the odds were that a student would graduate in 4 years before they showed up in school. You know, a student is 70% likely to graduate in 4 years. A student is 40% likely. They could have focused their resources on the people who were in the 50 to 70% likelihood, which is the rational thing to do, right? If you want to get graduation rate up, that's where you'd focus. They spent all their money on the students who are below 40%. You know, so they're being driven by a bunch of things, including equity as a concern. In Texas, the fights between Rick Perry and the former president of the university, you know, there was blood on the floor when those fights were done. But still, that's what they're doing. Take a question or two more. Yeah?
Yes, I'm George Chang, and I realized today that money is a big part of what you said, and I'll go a little further and illustrate that one sentence. Okay, I went to Princeton, and it was very clear that money was important, and raising money from alumni was important. Oh, by the way, Princeton was full of people who did not get into Amherst. But anyway, at Princeton, it was very clear that people have known for decades, maybe centuries, that one good way to assure generous alumni is to make sure that they were happy alumni. And one way to assure that you have happy alumni is to make sure you have happy students. And if you try to make your students happy, despite having a faculty that has pretty rigorous standards, then basically you're doing exactly what you just told us about.
Right. So why did I go to Amherst College? And this is why visit Amherst College, aside from the fact that I went there? Because Amherst College enrollment has been transformed in the last decade. It is 40% underrepresented minorities. It is 10% international students, and I don't mean the sons of the Shahs. It's got students who are community college transfers. This is all new. And they did it because they thought it was the right thing to do, but they also did it because they thought, and there are a lot of very competent students who fit that category. Amherst is just admitting, you know, 500 students a year. You can find great students who fit that category, really great students. Because they realize, you look down the road, who's going to be running the country in the next generation? They are going to be running in the country in the next generation. So it's it was both the morally right thing to do and the practical thing to do from their point of view. And so now their task is, okay, how do you take this college on a hill, which just looks so forbidding to somebody coming from the inner city, right? I mean, you can just, you know, pretty brick buildings and a tower and a chapel and all that stuff. How do you make that place inviting to those students? How do you give those students a sense that they belong at Amherst? They're not going to drop out because everybody wants the diploma. They're very practical about that. But how do you really make them feel a part of the college? That's the Rolls-Royce version. And the question is, how does City University of New York Community College, Georgia State, Long Beach State, how do they do the Kia version of that model? And that's what I am focused on. Thank you so much. I really had a...
We have a student question.
Hi, my name is Janice. I'm a fourth year undergraduate here at Cal. I also work with the Bridges Multicultural Resource Center, which aims to recruit and retain first generation low income students of color. And a question that I have is, how do you get faculty and administrators to get on board with what you say in terms of increasing student success? Because for the last 4 years, we've been trying to talk to administrators and faculty about increasing student retention for first-gen low-income students of color, but there are no actionable steps. So I guess, how do you get folks to start moving or mobilizing towards that?
Well, I'm going to tell you a story and make a suggestion. The suggestion is, we got a new chancellor. Go say hello. Go say hello to the new chancellor. I'm very fond of her. The story goes like this. So I was on a, quote, commission, a faculty commission to improve student engagement in the campus. Improve undergraduate education for the campus. A commission. It's a big deal. So the chancellor comes in, a past chancellor, and says, I don't know anything about undergraduate education. I haven't thought about it for 10 years. But you guys are smart. You can do something. And he's walking out the door, and I said, Mr. Chancellor, with respect, you underestimate what you've done. When you came, faculty members who taught freshman seminars, which are off the books extra one credit courses, were paid got $1,000 worth of travel and book money. You raise that amount to $2,000. Lo and behold, more people are teaching freshman seminars. So I said, there's a message here. If you don't make undergraduate education a priority, faculty members have a lot of empathy, but there's a limited amount of it. And if you don't signal that you care about this stuff, nothing more is going to happen. And you know better than I do what has happened. And my hope is that this is the window of opportunity for something to happen. Great question, and thank you for asking it. Sandwiches and stuff.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.